Support for the Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm David Gustina. Joining us this week is Lauren DeRosier. She's the senior staff attorney, adjunct professor, and the incoming director of the Immigration Law Clinic at Albany Law School. Welcome, Lauren.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. How do you find yourself back in the region? I know you told me before coming on air you're from Columbia County, but here you are upstate in Albany about to become the new director of the Immigration Law Clinic. What brings you to our area?
Quite frankly, the Immigration Law Clinic does. I grew up in Columbia County. I didn't anticipate that I would be moving back to upstate New York, but after spending some time in other parts of the country and going to law school and working down in New York City for a while, I found myself coming back to the area because there was an opening for a staff attorney position at the Immigration Law Clinic. And I have had the wonderful fortune to work with Sarah Rogerson for the past couple years and looking forward to continuing to work with her, hopefully in a different capacity for the foreseeable future.
Well, let's talk definitions here for a moment. I know before we came on, I said migrants, and she said, I'd like to say immigrants. And there's a reason behind all that. Will you explain to folks why you want people to say immigrants, not migrants?
Yes. So I think that one of the things that I have seen recently over the past couple years is a shift in terminology from a collective immigration focus on immigration and immigrants to kind of separating communities. So now I think some of the verbiage and terminology that New York City, for instance, is using is kind of splitting people between asylum seekers and migrants. And I think that that's the wrong approach, because I think that it artificially creates division between a community, and it posits one group as more worthy than another group without actually being based in anything particular. And I think that migrants in particular, I want to steer away from, because that is often a term that is outside of the immigration structure. There's like a view in that kind of word that means that people aren't actually able to access the legal immigration system. And that's not necessarily true, because I think that the immigration system as it currently exists is in many ways very broken, but it's a lot more complicated. It's not cut and dry. And just because somebody might not have status right now or might not be eligible to pursue status right now doesn't mean that they won't be in the future.
And isn't there a huge misconception among the American people about whether someone's here legally or illegally? I'm speaking specifically of asylum seekers, for example.
Yes. Every time I teach immigration law, I do a little dance at the front of the room to walk through how varied and gray most of immigration is. It's not you have status or you don't have status. There are varying types of status. They're temporary. There are some where you might be able to stay in the United States despite having a removal order having been entered against you. And it's a much more complicated, nuanced, ongoing process rather than a state of being. So, for instance, it's not illegal. There's no criminal reason. There's no criminal penalty for just being in the United States without documentation. That's not a crime. And I think talking in terms of legal or illegal, that misconstrues the way that immigration actually works, and it puts it in a criminal terminology context. Immigration law is not criminal law. Immigration is civil. Immigration detention is civil. And one thing that I want to raise up is that the process by which we assess whether somebody can remain in the country or not often can include people who are U.S. citizens. So these protections aren't just for a certain segment of the population. They're for everybody. And as soon as we start chipping away at a lot of the protections that we have in the in those contexts and allowing certain segments of the population to, for instance, be reported to ICE, that starts chipping away at everybody's protections, right? So we saw that particularly with the protests in Portland in 2020 with DHS having arrested and targeted U.S. citizens, like particularly U.S. citizens. And so I think that that really highlights how the protections that we give to the most vulnerable are protections for all of us.
Well, and the most vulnerable have been shipped all over the country, including here in New York. And this is playing politics with human beings for sure. I think most people agree with that. But what is our status? Give us an update on New York and what's happening now. We saw so many immigrants coming into New York City. There was issues with housing them and protecting them. And you had some upstate areas, including Albany, declaring themselves sanctuary cities and welcoming migrants. Others said, no way, keep them away. And this political football using human beings continues, wrapped up in politics, which, you know, when you look at the birthright of this country, as we all come from somewhere else, kind of smacks that value right in the face, doesn't it?
It sure does. And I think one thing that I really want to highlight is how much of an opportunity this is to hold fast to our values and the values that we have as New Yorkers, as, you know, Americans in kind of like whatever sense of the word that means to you. Hold to the protection and the welcoming kind of postures that we've held ourselves out to have. Right now, there are over 900 people who have been relocated by New York City to the Albany area. Many of the local organizations have been working very hard to make sure that people are taken care of. And one of the reasons that the organizations locally have had to work so hard is because the vendor from New York City was not adequately prepared to do the things that they had been contracted to do.
And that's an organization called DocGo, right? And they were involved with COVID initially, and then they got the contract for immigration, and that didn't go well.
It did not. And we found out earlier this week that the New York City mayor's office will not be renewing their contract for the relocations and for also the care that they are providing to people in New York City. However, DocGo has had its contract extended for people who are upstate through the remainder of the year. So that is something that we will continue to negotiate around. I think that there has been a lot of really excellent reporting coming out of several Albany reporters, and I think that the New York City Comptroller has done a very good job of advocating for more thoughtful use of those funds. One thing I think that we're seeing, and I see in a lot of different places throughout immigration, throughout the country, is the kind of idea of like disaster capitalism and profiteering. And that's something that I find really concerning, because these are people. Their presence is not a crisis. They are, at the end of the day, kind of ending up being the scapegoats for for-profit corporations to make a lot of money off of. And I am hopeful that as things turn to kind of more established organizations that know what they're doing, that have backgrounds in immigration or resettlement, that a lot of the concerns that we've had from the very beginning up here will start to be addressed.
In the meantime, you are addressing them at the Immigration Law Clinic, right? You and your students are working to help with this situation. Tell us a little bit more about that.
So what we're doing is we're really supporting our local organizations. So for instance, the Legal Project and Prisoners Legal Services have really done some incredible work around making sure that people don't fall through the cracks. So one of the issues that we have upstate is there's no immigration court in Albany. For people who are in Albany, they're venued out of Buffalo, so that's a very far away. And there aren't enough immigration lawyers here. So for instance, I have students who are graduating this semester who would love to stay in the area and do humanitarian immigration work, but there aren't any jobs. And so one of the hopes, I think, long term is that this will demonstrate the need for more investment in immigration legal resources.
We did even see, I think, what was a Westchester County executive, George Latimer, said, we'll set up an immigration court here in Westchester County. That idea came out and then flew away.
Yep. And I think one thing that we have advocated for kind of throughout the country, and this is one of the things that a lot of immigration advocacy groups really have targeted as one of the answers to kind of fixing a lot of the systemic problems, is more immigration courts, more immigration judges, more asylum officers, because a lot of those agencies were really caught up in dealing with some administrative hurdles between like 2016 and like 2022 or so. And a lot of those are still kind of like being worked through, but the kind of damage that the Trump administration did to the inner workings of those administration or of those agencies.
In terms of dismantling, firing, things like that?
Yeah, and implementing policies. So for instance, immigration judges didn't have as much control over their docket. They had restrictions on what they could do for cases. So instead of being able to terminate cases that they would be able to, so that people would be able to go pursue status through a different agency because of the many different agencies that affect immigration, you can't always get the form of relief that you're eligible for in the forum that you're set in. So the immigration judges were prevented from doing that. So it ended up, they weren't able to move cases off of their docket and their dockets ballooned. Right now, the asylum officers are conducting more credible fear interviews, which is like the very, very, very beginning stage of an asylum claim that happens when you enter at the southern border. They're doing more of those upfront as quickly as possible than they were doing during the Trump administration. And that all serves to kind of move people out of the system as quickly as possible. But you can't do that when the system is as backlogged as it is.
And not to forget that it was Kamala Harris who was sent to handle the immigration problem. She went down to the border and said, turn around and go back.
Yeah. And I think one thing that I am concerned about is how a lot of the people who are administering kind of the immigration responses don't have any fluency in immigration law, immigration policy, the history of why the situation is the way it is. And that's really concerning to me because it means that there are kind of like short-term stopgap solutions that address maybe like the very preliminary thing that's right in front of you, but doesn't actually address the systemic issues. So it really doesn't make a big difference. And we're seeing that not just at the federal government level, but, you know, I think at the state government and then definitely at the New York City government level. The New York City government does not have anybody who is running kind of their response to the increase in people who are seeking shelter there who don't have permanent immigration status. None of them have any background in immigration, and they've admitted that like in public, on the public record. And that's really concerning because it means that a lot of the opportunities that should be facilitated for people are missed out.
And it shows you how connected the locality is to the state, is to the federal government here, right? I mean, you talked about stopgap fill-in options. We saw the governor of New York, Kathy Hochul, put $2.4 billion from the state into this issue. She took it out of the rainy day fund, which got her criticized, even from the state comptroller, because I think part of this is the federal government needs to get off its haunches and really decide on some of these issues, the very issues you're talking about, and have the plans in place, you know, set up the immigration courts, work with the states, get the people, the bodies, the people, the experts in those locations and start helping people.
I definitely agree with that. I think that one of the concerns that I have with some of the state funding is that it's going to New York City rather than going to the local organizations directly. And I think as more contractors, as more emergency contractors get pulled into the New York City response, it means that a lot of money is going to corporate pockets rather than actually to the people who, one, are doing the work, two, are actually affected. So for instance, the New York State Relocation Assistance Program that is run by local organizations is severely underfunded. They don't have enough money. Centro Civico Ibero up here has been doing a really fantastic job. And a lot of that could be the solution, but the state isn't funding it to the extent that they could. I could go on for a very long time about what the federal government is doing or not doing. I think there is such a impasse at this point that it's hard to kind of see a way around. The federal government hasn't acted on immigration reform in 20 to 30 years. And that requires Congress. So Congress has to change the statute in order to actually have meaningful, real change and address the issues. That's not happening. What's left are agency rulemaking and executive order. Agency rulemaking tends to get wrapped up in litigation. Executive order does too, but it's quicker. I think one of the problems that is...
And can be undone by the next president.
And can be undone. And even then, one of the things that is troubling to myself and a lot of other immigration advocates is the way that the Biden administration is kind of caving to a lot of very, very right policies. So, for instance, the calls to shut down the border were a Trump-era attempt. The courts decided in, like, I think 2018 that the provisions that Biden is citing to were not, they couldn't do the things that Trump was trying to use them to do. And now we just see Biden trying to do the same thing, even though we now know, per the courts, that that's not how that works.
But that's where we get into the politics of fear and raw politics, right? Because the Republicans are spreading fear about immigrants and what they could possibly do or bring with them when they come through. You got an election year where Biden and Trump are back facing each other. Biden knows that's a salient issue. And if you want to convince the independents, he's probably calculating, I stay a little to the right on this until the election. Now you have in all of this the group of people that's probably hurt the most, children.
I think that immigrant children are often the most vulnerable people who have so little protection and are so overlooked. So, for instance, there are very few protections that make sure that immigrant children aren't exploited, that they aren't returned to situations in their home countries where they would face violence or persecution or real harm. The New York Times has been doing some significant reporting around the ways that in the United States, children who come without family have been subjected to like some pretty significant labor violations and requirements to work. And all of that is really concerning. And that's in the backdrop of there's no right to an attorney in immigration court because it's not criminal. And so children end up having to represent themselves. Even if they're very young.
Where is the logic in all of this?
I am encouraged that you think that there is logic.
Okay, good. So I don't think there's logic. It doesn't seem to make any sense to me. It'd be one thing that we could all agree on. Children should have a representative in that room.
There are some really great organizations. So for instance, KIND, Kids in Need of Defense, who do an incredible job of providing counsel and representation to children, but there is no right to an attorney. And that is, I think, one of the fundamental ways that some of the enormous amounts of money that are being spent at the New York State and New York City level should be redirected to immigration attorneys. The New York City Comptroller released a report recently about the effects of the very, very good economic effects of providing people with immigration counsel. You're, I think, 10 to 11 times more likely to succeed in your immigration claim if you have a lawyer representing you in immigration court. And I think while there have been a lot of really remarkable attempts by organizations to try to increase the efficacy of the limited funds that are available through pro se or self-represented guidance policies. It's not the same thing as having an immigration lawyer standing with you in immigration court who understands one of the most complicated parts of the law as it is in the United States today. And I think that one of the things that really needs to be funded is immigration legal representation. For instance, all of this money that's being spent, there are no permanent positions for immigration lawyers that have been created in the region. We have about 10 nonprofit immigration lawyers in the region, and there's really nobody else around. You have to go out to like Rochester and Syracuse to the west, and then up to Plattsburgh, there's nobody else around. So it's really the entirety of upstate New York is very parched in terms of lawyers in general, and then immigration lawyers in particular.
You're speaking with Lauren DeRosier. She is the senior staff attorney, adjunct professor, and incoming director of the Immigration Law Clinic at Albany Law School. Lauren, it's not going to get easier. It's going to get worse, isn't it? With climate change and everything else, people are moving from one part of the globe where climate doesn't make it livable or it's untenable to live anymore, and they're going to be coming to areas where it is better. And quite frankly, the Northeast is one of those areas. So we need to be out in front of this, and we're already way behind.
Yes. And I think one of the things that is with a lot of the climate migration in the United States today, it's not even just international. It's also within the United States. Yeah. So, for instance, I know people who have recently immigrated from San Francisco to the East Coast because of the fires, and they don't want to raise their children in an environment where there's a lot of smoke and fire and it's difficult for them to breathe.
Although we do have our Canadian fires that may lend some of that too.
But, you know, upstate New York is one of the best places to be in terms of the effects of climate change.
Natural disasters, you name it. We're pretty safe location for most things.
Upstate New York is pretty great. But I am hopeful that eventually some of the impasse will pass and we'll be able to actually move forward with finding actual solutions, because I, as it currently stands, I'm not really hopeful that things are going to get better in terms of actually making policy, actually making law that cares for the people. And that is government's role, right? Like, the government is responsive to the people. The government is supposed to care for the populace. And that is not what is happening in most areas, not just immigration. So I am hopeful that I think as more people become really engaged in finding their voices and advocating for the things that they need to do to survive. And I think particularly like my students, like younger people are really holding a lot of the politicians of the kind of like inaction to task. I'm really hopeful that that will have some sort of effect, because as it currently stands, kind of the entrenched power dynamics are making change impossible.
I agree with you. Many of my students are really tuned into the inequities in the world and they want to solve those. Let's hope they don't get jaded by the time they get there.
I like to call myself a cynical optimist.
Nice.
Because this is something that when I teach my students immigration law, it's hard not to become cynical. Immigration is based on racism. Yeah. Chinese Exclusion Act is like the beginning of federal immigration policy. And so much of what immigration law does, if you look at kind of the history of it, you see the realities of what the United States does and what it prioritizes and how much it has prioritized white supremacy.
And look, former President Trump is saying, you know, we need people from Denmark, places like Denmark, you know, the good countries.
People flee the United States to go to Denmark.
Correct.
Also, I don't want to let Democrats off the hook because, you know, for instance, Eric Adams, the mayor of New York City, has said some really horrific things that I'm not going to repeat because I don't want to give that more coverage. But Democrats are not necessarily better. And I think one of the things that has been really surprising, particularly in the past 6 months or so, is the really rightward swing of a lot of Democrats, particularly with regard to immigration.
Well, you're always going to have an anomaly. You're always going to have an immigrant involved in something that's illegal or bad. They're going to then use that as the example for all immigrants. You've got the head of the city of New York. He's got a job to do. It's going to be held with him. So you see where this all falls down on fear again. We're back to fear, right? Isn't it just about fear? Like, what are these people going to do to us? We did a great piece in Albany on the number of immigrants who have come, established businesses, and are surviving and working together and asking for no handouts.
The xenophobia and the fear rhetoric is very good for politics. It's very good for creating a base. It is not based in fact at all. Immigrants are about half as likely to commit crime than U.S.-born citizens. That has been proven over and over again, including by the Cato Institute, which is a right-leaning libertarian think tank. And they have done several studies regarding the crime rates for immigrants versus U.S.-born citizens. And that's backed up by pretty much all the data. It's been researched time and time again, and pretty much definitively, immigrants make communities safer.
Well, it's a discussion that needs to continue. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Our guest has been Lauren DeRosier, senior staff attorney, adjunct professor, and the incoming director of the Immigration Law Clinic at Albany Law School. Lauren, what a pleasure meeting you. I hope you'll come back and talk more as this problem continues in our state.
Well, I'm always happy to come back and rant about immigration, so I'm looking forward to it.
Me too.
The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. You can listen to The Capital Connection anytime at wamcpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcast. And join us again next week at this same time for another political conversation. For The Capital Connection, I'm David Giustino.
Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative.